For more information on Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please visit our website.
Well, we have an honored guest speaker, Rob Lyons, from Berkeley, California, who's here to speak to us about engaged Buddhism. And Rob is here to witness and blog about the Democratic National Convention. He was previously in Milwaukee doing the same and hang out with our sister Sangha in Milwaukee Zen Center. He was doing the same for the Republican National Convention. So let's welcome him to Chicago, and thank you very much for spending time with us and offering the Dharma of practicing with our political situation. So thank you very much, Rob.
You're welcome. Good morning.
Good morning.
Do I need to turn? Is that the microphone there?
Everything's fine for the sound.
Oh, okay, good. You can read along with that. My name is Rob Lyons. I'm from Berkeley. Mm-hmm. And I've been a Zen student since the mid-90s. And I practiced with Sojin Mel Weitzman, the abbot. He was the abbot of the Berkeley Zen Center for 50 years and passed away 3.5 years ago. Sojin ordained me as a lay practitioner in 2002 and gave me the name Gyoshi Kirei, which means striding lion, resolute effort. And I don't think he knew me very well, so he took my last name and put it in my document. I've done practice periods at Green Gulch and Tassajara and San Francisco City Center, and I've been involved in various practice positions at BZC for many years, and now I serve on the board. In fact, after this, I have a board meeting I have to tune into. I was an activist before I became a Buddhist. When I was in high school, we all protested against the war in Vietnam. And I attended the moratorium march in 1969 in Washington, D.C., which was really the first time there was a mass nationwide protest against the war, and it took off from there. Participating in that political activity was pretty much a formative action for me, and it fixed in my character a strong urge to act in this way, to protest and to organize positive social change, which has been with me for over 50 years. So it was a really seminal moment. When I was in my 30s and 40s, I had a career in urban redevelopment in the Bay Area cities of San Jose and Oakland, and I raised a family. I have 3 kids. They're all straddling 40, and I have 3 grandchildren. When the householder phase of my life was over, I came back to activism, and I was involved with the Buddhist Peace Fellowship in the early 2000s, especially in the build-up to the Iraq War. I think Tigan and I did some things together about that. In 2004, I participated in a 28-day march from the Democratic Convention in Boston, which ended at the end of July in that year, to the Republican Convention in New York. 28 days and 268 miles. That was I felt like I should write a sort of expose about it. It was a lot of anarchists and black bloc kids. There were two Buddhists who were trying to keep a lid on things. And later in 2004, I participated in a project that was dreamt up by some friends of mine at BZC, which they called a Buddhist election sesshin. And it's been since rebranded as an election retreat. A group of us moved to a house in Corvallis, Oregon, during the 2 weeks just before the 2004 election, and we lived together and practiced in a sesshin format. We opened every day with periods of meditation and a Dharma talk and a shared breakfast, and then concluded the day with a shared dinner and a final period of zazen. And in the afternoon, instead of chopping vegetables or cleaning the temple, we went out and walked precincts to get out the boat. And this blending of practice and activism had the advantage of grounding our political work in mindfulness and open-heartedness, and at the same time bringing the outside world into the Zendo and rooting our meditation practice in compassion. We've been working with the same basic model for 20 years now, through the Bush years and the Obama years and the Trump years and the Biden years, and I expect we'll continue doing it during the Harris years as well. In 2020, when the pandemic took place, we decided to take our election retreats online. And so we did a dozen online letter writing retreats over a 6-month period, each about 4 hours long, and about 700 people participated, and we wrote more than 30,000 letters to voters in 6 swing states. We also raised a bunch of money, which we contributed to grassroots organizations in Georgia, which in our small way helped to bring the two runoff. You remember there were 2 Senate runoff races, Raphael Warnock and John Ossoff, and they both won those races, which had far-reaching implications. And we did similar work in 2022, and then a year later, last year, some of us went to Wisconsin to campaign for Janet Protasiewicz, who won a seat on the Wisconsin Supreme Court, which actually really shifted the political dynamic in Wisconsin pretty dramatically. This year, in May, some of our group organized a Sit for Democracy, in which we raised over $50,000 for the same kinds of grassroots organizations that we had done in 2020. And we've started a program of online postcard writing retreats. Roshi Joan Halifax gave a talk a couple of weeks ago. And then last week, Dekala Chungyalpa, who's an inspiring young Buddhist ecologist from the University of Madison, Wisconsin, gave us a talk. There's 7 more of these planned for the year, including one on the 25th by Hozan Allen Sanaki, the abbot of the Berkeley Zen Center. And then finally, this year we're going to be resuming our in-person residential Get Out the Vote retreats, the same model as I mentioned before. 3 of them, one in Carson City, Nevada, where we've actually done 4 before, one in Milwaukee and one in Oconomowoc, Wisconsin. So there'll be 2 retreats in Wisconsin. And just last night, we posted the registration form for the website. We've already had people starting to sign up. So if you want to come to Wisconsin and work on the retreat, please join us. So I want to turn now to the subject of engaged Buddhism. And I want to start by reading a poem by Thich Nhat Hanh, a very famous poem called Call Me by My True Names. Don't say I will depart tomorrow. Even today, I am still arriving. Look deeply. Every second, I am arriving. To be a bud on a spring branch, to be a tiny bird with still fragile wings, learning to sing in my new nest, to be a caterpillar in the heart of a flower, to be a jewel hiding itself in a stone. I still arrive in order to laugh and to cry, to fear and to hope. The rhythm of my heart is the birth and death of all that is alive. I'm a mayfly metamorphosing on the surface of the river, and I am the bird that swoops down to swallow the mayfly. I'm a frog swimming happily in the clear water of a pond, and I am the grass snake that silently feeds itself on the frog. I'm the child in Uganda, all skin and bones, my legs as thin as bamboo sticks, and I am the arms merchant selling deadly weapons to Uganda. I am the 12-year-old girl, refugee on a small boat, who throws herself into the ocean after being raped by a sea pirate. And I am also the pirate, my heart not yet capable of seeing and loving. I'm a member of the Politburo with plenty of power in my hands. And I'm the man who has to pay his debt of blood to my people, dying slowly in a forced labor camp. My joy is like spring, so warm it makes flowers bloom all over the earth. My pain is like a river of tears, so vast it fills the four oceans. Please call me by my true names, so I can hear all my cries and laughter all at once, so I can see that my joy and pain are one. Please call me by my true names, so I can wake up and the door of my heart could be left open, the door of compassion. So this poem goes to the root of engaged Buddhism, which is the practice of compassion. To me, this poem speaks to that moment in samadhi when you feel it and you really get it in your bones that there is no inside and outside, that the sounds around you are not separate from you. The abundance and heartbreak and beauty and cruelty and murderous rage and tenderness, there's no boundary between what's me and what's other. And of course, at other times, all of these elements dissolve entirely and there's nothing that has any substance or individual identity. So in a sense, if we're going to practice engaged Buddhism, we have to engage in a kind of code switching, where at the same time we recognize the suffering and respond to it, and we know that it has no reality, but try telling that to the young girl who had been raped by the sea pirate. One of the themes of my teacher, Sojin, was continuous practice, taking the mindfulness of Zazen and carrying it around with you as you go about your day. And another favorite and related theme was the need to bring forth an appropriate response to whatever arises. I've been thinking about compassionate action in the context of dependent co-arising. We have this mental model of how we respond to suffering. We open ourselves to the experience of others, and we perceive their suffering, and we hear their cries. In the words of Maile Scott's Metta Prayer, 1,000 hands, each hand with an eye in it, the instinctive knowing what to do. We feel what they're feeling, or their expression of pain triggers a sympathetic response and brings forth a feeling of our own history or biography that resonates. And we stay there. We don't turn away or tamp it down. We feel it, and a response arises, and we act. There's a response. We express that response. We begin to weep in sympathy, or we embrace the person who is suffering, or we move to dress the wound or ask what we can do to help. We find ourselves asking this question, and Ram Dass wrote a book about this, How Can I Help? We find an answer, and we act. It might seem like these things happen in sequence, one after the other, each serving as the cause and condition of the next, but it's equally possible that they arise together, dependent on one another and all triggering at once, the perception, the opening, the feeling, the sympathy, the response. And I'm actually wondering about this and starting to investigate it. One of the things that I'm troubled by is my own preference for hanging out in a place that's cool and calm, and even for staying in my head, even as my heart or my body is roiled by deeper and barely perceptible emotion. And so when I do feel strong emotion, I'm often inexperienced and skillful at riding it and staying with it. Zen is often described as a body practice, centering your attention on the hara and relaxing all the muscles except what you need to keep your spine upright, especially relaxing the belly and the shoulders. These put us in much closer and intimate touch with our emotions. And if we stay in this place and let the emotions flow through us, we can learn a lot about where they're coming from and how to respond. And by letting go of the resistance to these emotions and not divulging in the reflex of turning away or recoiling, we can get more comfortable living with them. And I believe, I hope that is, that this will help us develop our instinct and our ability to recognize without thinking, our ability to see at a glance what's needed. So each of us has our own individual makeup, and we're triggered by different experiences or stimuli. And at different times in our lives, we feel different things, depending on what's going on with us and how much stress we're under, how our body feels, how people are treating us, and whether that sets us on edge. And as we age, we go through physical and chemical changes that make us more or less prone to being receptive or reactive. I've been getting very forgetful recently, as I think a lot of my friends are, especially with people's names. And I actually think that my mind is weakening. I'm also a sucker for small kids, like the kid that we heard outside during Zazen. I just think that they're so adorable. And I think this is partly because I'm in this grandfatherly period. And I'm afraid before long I'm going to be buying calendars with kittens and puppies on them. We also all differ in our personal take on what's an appropriate response. Some of us want to fix things. I was joking with Lori last night about how I resonate with Tim Walz, the Democratic candidate for vice president, because he's so helpful and he wants to take care of everybody and fix stuff. Another person might listen and empathize, and someone else might take a longer view and watch, like Suzuki's famous parable of giving the cow a wide pasture and watching her. So I want to tell a little story here. I mentioned Ram Dass. In 1966, I think it was, I went with a friend to a conference in Killarney, Ireland, of a group known as the International Transpersonal Association. I was in my 40s and my kids were, I think, 11, 13, and 16. I'd been divorced for 5 or 6 years, and I was at an inflection point in my career, and I really wanted to do something that had more meaning and depth and relevance, something with a spiritual component where I would be doing good. And at this conference, there were all these very wise and illustrious people, and they were giving talks and workshops about some things that were edgy and deep. And so I thought I might ask some of them for advice. I was in the lobby of the Great Southern Hotel in Killarney, and Jack Kornfield walked by. So I went up to him, and I told him of my predicament, that I was reevaluating my life and looking for a new direction. And I asked if we might get together sometime during the week and have a cup of coffee and talk. And he said, actually, he was very busy all week and wouldn't be able to spare the time. Sorry. So I turned away, rejected and embarrassed. And just then Ram Dass walked by from the other direction. So I went up to him and I made my pitch. I'm reevaluating my life, et cetera, et cetera. Would he have time sometime later in the week to talk? He said, actually, I have a few minutes right now. So we walked over to the concierge desk and leaned against it, and I explained myself, and he listened very closely and very kindly. Here's my situation with my job and my family and my impulse to bring more meaning to what I'm doing and so on. And then he smiled that languid, meltingly warm smile that he had. And he said, you seem like someone who looks at the world as being very, very solid and real, and you seem pretty well grounded in that world. And you have these responsibilities, your three kids. I think you might want to consider that your first priority now is taking care of your kids and taking care of these responsibilities, because that's what's up for you now. If you still have this strong spiritual urge and desire to do good in the world, if these are deep and important to you, you can come back to this later on after your kids are off on their own. Now, this is exactly the kind of thing that my father and mother might have said to me. And of course, I would have dismissed it coming from them. But coming from Ram Dass, one of the popularizers of LSD and now a Hindu holy man, this is completely different. I've always thought it resembled Nixon's opening to China, you know, like shocking and compelling. So I thanked him and we walked our separate ways, and I made the decision then and there to renew my commitment to taking care of my kids until they were self-reliant. And as it turned out, I did have a strong urge, and I continued to want to do good in the world, so these instincts and impulses were alive and well 6 years later when I got involved with the Buddhist Peace Fellowship. My kids were grown up. So I've always felt a debt of gratitude to Ram Dass for his kindness and his willingness to engage with me in that moment and his deep wisdom. That advice was really important to me and my children both, and our lives were made much richer by it. So thank you, Ram Dass, wherever you are. So this story illustrates a few points. First, the power of being fully in the present and bringing forth an appropriate response in that very moment. And second, the importance of thinking and planning strategically and considering the interests of a wide variety of affected people, of a whole community, of ecosystem, actually, and acting as a steward of that community. And third, the wisdom not to get carried away by the urgency we might feel and be overpowered by once we've got an idea in our head. So I want to circle back to the practice of engaged Buddhism. The practice of engagement, as Thich Nhat Hanh reminds us, arises from compassion. We can't turn away, and we should continue training ourselves not to turn away. The appropriate response will differ from one person to the next. Some of us will ameliorate the caregivers, the listeners and supporters, and the empathizers, the first responders. These are the people who bear the fullest weight of the suffering of others. Some people may help by guiding others through the labyrinth of care so that they can gradually improve their lives and be healed. And still others might focus on structures of suffering and the supply chain that delivers suffering to its reluctant recipients and work on combating injustice, hatred, economic discrimination, systematic misery, and so forth. The important thing, if you want to incorporate engaged Buddhism in your practice, is that you engage. Investigate opportunities to be of service. Maybe start small, start where you are. Or start where the need is greatest. You can set out on this path and pay attention to what happens as you travel it. How are you feeling about this? What is your gut telling you? Is this sustainable? Does this feel like you're helping? Is it urgent or essential or life-preserving? Personally, I believe the most important thing I can do right now is to devote myself to the project of keeping Donald Trump out of the White House, because I believe if that were to come about, it would dramatically increase the suffering of many, many Americans and many others around the world. I won't try and explain or justify this belief, just know it comes from a place of compassion and it animates me every day. First, make sure the patient doesn't die. Make sure democracy is preserved. Then we can turn our attention to the myriad other crises and emergencies that awake. The most pressing and heartbreaking of these being the horror of the Gaza war, where more than 14,000 Palestinian children have been killed, and the Ukraine war, and the juggernaut of climate change, which is becoming more and more deadly every year. And that's just the beginning. One thing about this work is it never ends, so I implore you, open your hearts and bring forth an appropriate response. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Rob. And this is the time in our program where we have about, I don't know, something like 15 minutes to have conversation before we wrap things up and have tea right after this, because that will give us a little bit of time to check in with Rob, too, after this more formal event. But especially people online, if you have any comments or questions or responses, you said so much, Rob, so there's quite a bit to course in. So please come forth with any responses or comments or questions.
I had a question about your thoughts on what to do when the candidate you're advocating for doesn't win. I'm a physician, so I know what it's like to have the patient die. That happens. And I know how I respond to that because I have experience in that. But I struggle more with the political arena.
At the moment, it looks like there's a 49% chance that our candidate will not prevail. My candidate, I don't see your candidate. So that's a pretty strong possibility. There's a line in Maile Scott's Metta Prayer about doing the work independent of results. And I think I had I touched on this on one of my blogs about the difference between optimism and hope. Or optimism is sort of wishful thinking, where hope is more like a strategy, a commitment to a program of doing things in the world that's not dependent on results. It's just work that you do, you do it. So we can't control whether the patient dies or not. But we do the work that we do because that's what we do. Because if we didn't do that work, then all of the support that we and myriad other people provide in the world wouldn't be there. You wouldn't want to get discouraged because, I think in the blog I likened it to raising a child. You wouldn't stop raising a child because they had a problem or because you got mad at them. You just keep on putting that work in. So that's the level of our devotion to this work. And if Trump wins, there's going to be hell to pay. It's going to be hugely traumatic, but we'll have to deal with that when and if it occurs. And I actually think the prospect of that happening is enough to get a lot of people energized and working very, very hard to make sure it doesn't happen. If it does happen, then we deal with it then. Yeah.
So could you say more about when you do go door to door? How do you listen to people?
The work we do door to door is to get out the vote. So for the most part, we're going to talk to Democrats or sometimes independents, but mostly Democrats. It's not a confrontational encounter, and it doesn't generally have the character of trying to talk them into your viewpoint. Sometimes it has that quality because I've run into quite a few people say, I don't like either of these people. The system is screwed up. I don't see why I should vote. And then you get into a conversation about what's behind that for them. I was in Carson City a couple of years ago, and this woman came to the door, and there was a guy who'd been living in an ADU just behind the house, and he came and joined the conversation, and he was totally disaffected and totally checked out on the system. And I started asking him about why. And oftentimes that's the best thing is to ask. You don't have to argue anything. You just ask them to come forward and you learn a lot, you connect with them. And often that's all it takes. Sometimes they vote and sometimes they don't, but that's the interaction is asking and listening.
Can you give an example of like a conversation you had where you felt there was a shift?
Yeah, well that conversation. Yeah, he shifted. When he started looking at how heartbroken he was, that the system was so screwed up that it was failing him. Him getting in touch with that and then taking that and comparing it to what would happen if the bad guys got in, I think really shifted his view. And he came out, he came into the conversation, ready to, pepper me with arguments and, talking points. And we ended the conversation in a totally different place.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you for coming and speaking with our group. I really appreciate it. I'm a teacher, and just like tomorrow, our school year starts basically.
Oh, yeah.
And I mean, first the week is.
What grade do you teach?
Fourth grade.
Oh, nice.
And, you know, we have staff this week, and then the next week is students. And, you know, this convention is happening in Chicago. And, you know, so I relate to the part of your talk where it's like, okay, this thing in front of you is what you need to sort of take care of. In other words, these kids that will be sort of filtering into my classroom. And on the other hand, it's like this election season is happening, and I share your sense of urgency. So it's like I feel like my head is in like 10 different places, you know, but I do want to, and I feel like there's the need to kind of bring it back to the classroom. But sometimes I feel like, is that enough? It's that those sort of levels you delineated of like that structural stuff. I also feel the need to sort of address too, but it's the energy isn't really, you know, once this kind of school year starts in, you know, in motion, it's hard to kind of think or do anything around that. So maybe my question is just like similar to yours, to Ram Dass and Jack Kornfield, like what to do, or maybe it's just like, is that okay to like, just to have that address the stuff right in front of you and have a kind of faith that other people are doing, you know, addressing the other stuff. I don't know, but I feel like head is in 10 different places and kind of what to do with that.
Well, there are things that you can do. I mean, you can write postcards and you can write checks and, you know, Wisconsin, not very far away. You could go knock doors. There's also things you can do in a classroom. You know, I don't know whether your school would allow having a conversation among your kids, where you ask them, you know, what do you guys see? What do you?
Yeah.
I mean, and again, I wouldn't say anything. I wouldn't project any ideas. I would just ask them to talk about how they look at the world and what do they hear from their parents and. You know, the kids can have conversations among themselves. You know, I mean, having that sort of like, I mean, there's a couple of 8-year-olds that I'm helping to raise, 8-year-old twins. And sometimes we have conversations like that about, you know, I mean, they actually hate Donald Trump. You know, their head's in the right place. But, you know, having that sort of awareness at that age, I think is important. It's important to encourage that. And also know that you'll like the advice that he gave me is that if the urge is strong, then you know it's not going to go away, and the time will present itself. So don't despair. Write postcards.
I'll use that as a segue too. I have a ton of postcards. Yeah. If anybody wants or needs them, there's always that opportunity, and I could even provide stamps. So, see how it got to. But the other thing I think, though, is that you come here, you sit, and Rob couldn't be here if you weren't here, kind of like Thich Nhat Hanh's poem at the beginning. So I just want to underscore that our presence, however we offer it, is, and when it comes from this place of compassion and settledness and caring, tells us where to go, which I think is basically what you and Ram Dass discuss.
The practice really just keep practicing, keep sitting.
Well, and I appreciate your recommendation to like bring it forward. Of course, they're thinking about all this stuff anyway. Sometimes I think in the school year, get kind of blinders on of like, I'm just covering what I need to cover, etc. But they do they want to talk about that stuff. They know what's happening. So, yeah, that's a good reminder to kind of.
Yeah, I think you have to be judicious about it. You know, you don't want kids going home and saying, this is what my teacher told me.
Yeah. Handing out t-shirts and stuff, yeah.
Yes.
Can you now then talk about when you go to a place like the Republican National Convention,
yeah,
what's your mindset going there, and then how are you engaging with people that you absolutely know don't agree with you?
Well, you know, I didn't actually engage them with them very much, okay. And I just published a blog yesterday about my plan for Chicago, what I'm going to do in Chicago. And this is not my plan for the city. This is my stay here. And I pointed out that that was one of the things that I should have done better, which is, you know, engaging more. I really hardly had any. I mean, I was in the presence of Republicans. And listen to them, but I didn't really have that much in the way of conversation. But this is a subject that I'm really interested in. There's a number of organizations and projects that are set up throughout the country. I think there was an article in the Washington Post where somebody talked about how this is somebody who had done a lot of peacemaking work around the world. And he talked about how the road to peace in places where there have been, you know, deadly conflicts is dialogue.
Yeah.
And there, okay. I think he listed a half a dozen different dialogue projects in the U.S.
Like Braver Angels.
Braver Angels is one of them. Yeah.
Right. So the guy Kappelman's coming tonight, and he's coming from a Braver Angels event.
Oh,
so
great.
Ask him about it.
Can you say something just briefly about that for the Sangha?
Okay. Yeah, it was just a night that Jerry would announce it.
Oh, okay. Go ahead.
Yeah. So Rob's, if you want to have dinner with Rob, I'm having people over, like from 5 to 8. So. And if you want to know the details,
see Eve or call Ancient Dragons, the note to ancientdragon.org. And so Eve is hosting this event, which is very kind of you. And I think former Alderman Kappelman is from, I forget the ward, but it's a lakefront ward. 46 ward, yeah, thank you very much. Paula lives in it. So that's really wonderful that we can continue this conversation. And Rob will be here for until what, next?
Saturday,
yeah. Mm-hmm. So some of us will be gone because we're going to Green Gulch Farm to do some practice. But Rob will be upstairs, so you know where to find him.
if you want to have a coffee or lunch or something, anytime. But I think that the key element there is having dialogue with people who disagree with you. There was another one of the moments in my blog that I was in this. I slipped into this meeting of some Never Trumpers, and. One of the people talked about this concept he called the coalition of the decent, which is basically the people in the middle, that, you know, the reasonable Republicans and the reasonable Democrats, how there would be a majority there of people who were like, they have a stake in preserving some sort of common sense. And care, and that's those are really the people that that these programs like Braver Angels are targeted at, which is, you know, people that could have a conversation. I mean, in Carson City, I had some encounters with people that were quite a bit further on the spectrum, And they're, you know, it's just like blaring at you and baiting, you know, trying to get some sort of reaction. And my strategy there is always to try and find something that you share with them. I'm going to actually write about this, but it's, you know, there's a tendency for people to take on, we all have a very broad personality. You know, whenever I go to somebody's wake, you know, a memorial, I think, God, I wish I'd known them better. What an interesting person. You know, so, but when we have these conversations, we sort of narrow down who we are to like really hard and, you know, armored positions Whereas if we met one another across the whole spectrum of who we are, we wouldn't focus on that conflict so much. So finding a way to not emphasize the disagreement so much, but to find common ground, that's what all of these programs are really oriented to doing, is, you know, knitting back together.
And yeah, Tigan, we have time for you. I just want to also mention that Paula is going into the belly of the beast and volunteering at the Democratic National Convention.
Oh,
I think
great.
You got an assignment. What is it?
Tomorrow I'm checking badges at the United Center. Hmm.
So a bouncer. so thank you for...
Does that mean somebody without a badge could still
right.
stop by?
The true Chicago way.
This is Chicago.
That's what I'm trying
it's
to do.
It's a price in Chicago.
You know.
I was willing to start at the airport and work my way down.
I saw them at the airport and at the subway.
Hotel, everywhere.
There was a table at the Blue Line telling me how to get around.
So, but on that note... I just want to check, does anybody online have a comment? There is someone?
Joe has his hand up.
Okay, and let's have Tigan comment, and then Joe, and then we need to wrap up so we can have tea with Rob for a minute, and then he'll have to flee to Berkeley online. So Tigan, please.
Just briefly, yeah, partly in response to Bo, we can't do everything, you know, in terms of an appropriate response. I'm writing postcards to voters in Michigan and Wisconsin, and maybe I'd like to get some.
Yeah, I've got plenty for Michigan. Yeah. And Michigan's a real swing state, so
Michigan and Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have a background like yours in demonstrating and back during the Vietnam War and since. And I can't really do that so well physically anymore. So we have to find what we can do. Mm-hmm. You know, writing postcards is one good thing to voters to come and vote. And, you know, and just talking to people, to friends and family in swing states. Mm-hmm. So, but also I want to encourage anybody who can go with Rob to Wisconsin to engage in a lecture retreat. And, you know, whatever else people can do.
I've been promoting the writing of postcards, and at the same time, I think it's a safe haven for a lot mm-hmm. of people. It's easier to write a postcard and write a check than it is to put yourself out there. So I think it's important, and especially in the context of practice, to find that, you know, push yourself out a little bit so that you're... you want to make sure the degree of difficulty is within, you know, what you can manage, but you want to be pushing a little bit. So write postcards, but also ask yourself whether there's more than that that you can do.
It's like sitting another period of zazen. It's like, well, maybe I won't sit this long,
yeah,
you know.
Right.
But you can if you offer that a little. And then let's talk to Joe. Have Joe offer his offering. And then we'll wrap up with the vows.
Thank you, sir. Good talk. I'll keep it brief. I had a career in social research, including a lot of political polling, and I've watched the science of methodology evolve over the years, not in a good direction, in my opinion. Just to make a long observation short, I think the polls are a bunch of shellac right now, and I think our chances are much better than 49%, to tell you the truth. I don't think we're getting the whole story. So I'm choosing not to be pessimistic. And thanks for the talk, and take care.
Thank you, Joe.
Thank you for encouraging us.
And thank you, everyone. We have an abbreviated program this morning, so we'll have tea directly after this. We'll chant the four vows. Rob will join us for a few minutes before he has to... go online with Berkeley Zen Center, and Chris is preparing tea for us. Thank you very much. And thank you so much to all you wonderful bodhisattvas for your engagement with Engaged Buddhism. And thank you, Rob, for joining us and encouraging us and offering your practice to us. So on that note, maybe we'll say goodbye to the people online, at least from Rob's screen, and then we'll do the four vows. So.
Solutions are inexhaustible. We vow to cut through them. Dharma pains are boundless. We vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. We vow to realize it. Beings are numberless. We vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. We vow to cut through them. Dharma aids are numberless. We vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. We vow to realize it. Beings are numberless. We vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. We vow to cut through them. Dharma gates are boundless. We vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. We vow to realize it.